night I couldn't find any money or any smack, so I came in here because it looked warm. The organizer asked if he'd be willing to try giving up the drugs for more than one night, and the man answered with admirable candor, "I could say yes, but honestly, probably not. I'll probably be back at it tomorrow night." I never saw that man again. Before he left, someone did ask him where he was from. "Well, I've lived here in Hamilton for most of my life, but I was born down in eastern Kentucky, Owsley County. At the time, I didn't know enough about Kentucky geography to tell the man that he had been born no more than 20 miles from my grandparents' childhood home." Chapter 8. By the time I finished 8th grade, Mom had been sober for at least a year, and she'd been dating Matt for 2 or 3 years. I was doing well in school, and Mamaw had taken a couple of vacations, one trip to California to visit Uncle Jimmy, and another to Las Vegas with her friend Kathy. Lindsay had married soon after Papaw's death. I loved her husband, Kevin, and still do, for a simple reason. He never mistreated her. That's all I ever wanted in a mate for my sister. Just under a year after their wedding, Lindsay gave birth to her son, Cameron. She was a mom, and a damn good one at that. I was proud of her, and I adored my new nephew. Aunt Wee also had 2 small children, which gave me 3 little kids to dote on. I saw all of this as a sign of family renewal. The summer before high school was thus a hopeful one. That same summer, however, Mom announced that I'd be moving in with Matt and his Dayton home. I liked Matt, and by then Mom had lived in Dayton with him for a little while. But Dayton was a 45-minute drive from Mamaw's, and Mom made it clear that she wanted me to attend school in Dayton. I liked my life in Middletown. I wanted to attend the high school, I loved my friends, and although it was a bit unconventional, I enjoyed splitting time between Mom's and Mamaw's houses during the week and hanging out with Dad on the weekends. Importantly, I could always go to Mamaw's house if I needed to, and that made all the difference. I remembered life when I didn't have that safety valve, and I didn't want to go back to those days. Moreover, any move would be without Lindsay and Cameron. So when Mom made her announcement about moving in with Matt, I belted out, "Absolutely not," and stormed away. Mom drew from this conversation that I had anger problems and scheduled a time for me to meet with her therapist. I didn't know she had a therapist or the money to afford one, but I agreed to meet with this lady. Our first meeting took place the following week in a musty old office near Dayton, Ohio, where a nondescript middle-aged woman, Mom, and I tried to understand why I was so angry. I recognized that human beings aren't very good at judging themselves. I may have been wrong that I was no angrier, in fact, considerably less so than most of the people in my life. Maybe Mom was right, and I did have some anger problems. I tried to keep an open mind. If nothing else, I thought, this woman might give Mom and me an opportunity to get everything in the open. But that first session felt like an ambush. Immediately, the woman began asking why I would scream at my mother and storm off, why I didn't recognize that she was my mother and that I had to live with her by law. The therapist chronicled outbursts I'd allegedly had, some going back to a time I couldn't remember. The time I threw a tantrum in a department store as a 5-year-old. My fight with another child in school, the school bully, whom I didn't want to punch but did so at Mamaw's encouragement. The times I'd run from home to my grandparents' house because of Mom's discipline. Clearly this woman had developed an impression of me based solely on what Mom had told her. If I didn't have an anger problem before, I did now. "Do you have any idea what you're talking about?" I asked. At 14, I knew at least a little about professional ethics. "Aren't you supposed to ask me what I think about things and not just criticize me?" I launched into an hour-long summary of my life to that point. I didn't tell the whole story, since I knew I had to choose my words carefully. During Mom's domestic violence case a couple of years earlier, Lindsay and I had let slip some unsavory details about Mom's parenting, and because it counted as a new revelation of abuse, the family counselor was required to report it to Child Services. So I didn't miss the irony of lying to a therapist to protect Mom, lest I ignite another intervention by the County Children's Services. I explained the situation well enough. After an hour, she said simply, "Perhaps we should meet alone." I saw this woman as an obstacle to overcome, an obstacle placed by Mom, not as someone who might help. I explained only half of my feelings, that I had no interest in putting a 45-minute barrier between me and everyone I had ever depended on, so I could replant myself with a man I knew would be sent packing. The therapist obviously understood. What I didn't tell her is that for the first time in my life, I felt trapped. There was no Papaw, and Mamaw, a longtime smoker with the emphysema to prove it, seemed too frail and exhausted to care for a 14-year-old boy. My aunt and uncle had two young kids. Lindsay was newly married and had a child of her own. I had nowhere to go. I'd seen chaos and fighting, violence, drugs, and a great deal of instability. But I'd never felt like I had no way out. When the therapist asked me what I'd do, I replied that I would probably go live with my dad. She said that this sounded like a good idea. When I walked out of her office, I thanked her for her time and knew that I'd never see her again. Mom had a massive blind spot in the way that she perceived the world. That she would ask me to move with her to Dayton, that she seemed genuinely surprised by my resistance, and that she would subject me to such a one-sided introduction to a therapist meant that Mom didn't understand something about the way that Lindsay and I ticked. Lindsay once told me, "Mom just doesn't get it." I initially disagreed with her. Of course she gets it. It's just the way she is, something she can't change. After the incident with the therapist, I knew that Lindsay was right. Mamaw was unhappy when I told her that I planned to live with Dad, and so was everyone else. No one really understood it, and I felt unable to say much about it. I knew that if I told the truth, I'd have a few people offering their spare bedrooms, and all of them would submit to Mamaw's demand that I live permanently with her. I also knew that living with Mamaw came with a lot of guilt, and a lot of questions about why I didn't live with my mom or dad, and a lot of whispers from a lot of people to Mamaw that she just needed to take a break and enjoy her golden years. That feeling of being a burden to Mamaw wasn't something I imagined. It came from a number of small cues, from the things she muttered under her breath, and from the weariness she wore like a dark piece of clothing. I didn't want that, so I chose what seemed like the least bad option. In some ways, I loved living with Dad. His life was normal and precisely the way I'd always wanted mine to be. My stepmom worked part-time but was usually home. Dad came home from work around the same time each day. One of them, usually my stepmom but sometimes Dad, made dinner every night, which we ate as a family. Before each meal, we'd say grace, something I'd always liked but had never done outside of Kentucky. On weeknights, we'd watch some family sitcom together, and Dad and Cheryl never screamed at each other. Once, I heard them raise their voices during an argument about money, but slightly elevated volumes were far different from screaming. On my first weekend at Dad's house, the first weekend I had ever spent with him when I knew that, come Monday, I wouldn't be going somewhere else, my younger brother invited a friend to sleep over. We fished in Dad's pond, fed horses, and grilled steaks for dinner. That night, we watched Indiana Jones movies until the early morning hours. There was no fighting, no adults hurling insults at one another, no glass china shattering angrily against the wall or floor. It was a boring evening, and it epitomized what attracted me to Dad's home. What I never lost, though, was the sense of being on guard. When I moved in with my father, I'd known him for 2 years. I knew that he was a good man, a little quiet, a devout Christian from a very strict religious tradition. When we first reconnected, he made it clear that he didn't care for my taste in classic rock, especially Led Zeppelin. He wasn't mean about it, that wasn't his style, and he didn't tell me I couldn't listen to my favorite bands. He just advised that I listen to Christian rock instead. I could never tell my dad that I played a nerdy collectible card game called Magic, because I feared he'd think the cards were satanic. After all, kids at the church youth group often spoke of magic and its evil influence on young Christians. And as most teenagers do, I had so many questions about my faith. Whether it was compatible with modern science, for instance, or whether this or that denomination was correct on particular doctrinal disputes. I doubt he would have gotten upset if I'd asked those questions, but I never did because I didn't know how he'd respond. I didn't know whether he'd tell me that I was a spawn of Satan and send me away. I didn't know how much of our new relationship was built on his sense that I was a good kid. I didn't know how he'd react if I listened to those Zeppelin CDs in his house with my younger siblings around. That not knowing gnawed at me, to the point where I could no longer take it. I think Mamaw understood what was going on in my head, even though I never told her explicitly. We spoke on the phone frequently, and one night she told me that I had to know she loved me more than anything, and she wanted me to return home when I was ready. "This is your home, JD. And always will be." The next day, I called Lindsay and asked her to come and get me. She had a job, a house, a husband, and a baby, but she said, "I'll be there in 45 minutes. I apologized to Dad, who was heartbroken by my decision, but he understood. "You can't stay away from that crazy grandma of yours. I know she's good to you." It was a stunning admission from a man to whom Mamaw never said a nice word. and it was the first indication that Dad understood the complex and conflicting feelings I developed. That meant a great deal to me. When Lindsay and her family came to get me, I got in the car, sighed, and said to her, "Thanks for taking me home." I gave my infant nephew a kiss on the forehead and said nothing else until we got to Mamaw's. I spent the rest of the summer mostly with Mamaw. A few weeks with Dad had given me no epiphanies. I still felt caught between a desire to stay with her and a fear that my presence was depriving her of the comforts of old age. So before my freshman year started, I told Mom that I'd live with her so long as I could stay in Middletown schools and see Mamaw whenever I wanted. She said something about needing to transfer to a Dayton school after my freshman year, but I figured we'd cross that bridge in a year when we had to. Living with Mom and Matt was like having a front row seat to the end of the world. The fighting was relatively normal by my standards and Mom's, but I'm sure poor Matt kept asking himself how and when he'd hopped the express train to Crazy Town. It was just the three of us in that house, and it was clear to all that it wouldn't work out. It was only a matter of time. Matt was a nice guy, and as Lindsay and I joked, nice guys never survived their encounters with our family. Given the state of Mom's and Matt's relationship, I was surprised when I came home from school one day early during my sophomore year, and Mom announced that she was getting married. Perhaps, I thought, things weren't quite as bad as I expected. "I honestly thought you and Matt were going to break up," I said. "You fight every day." "Well," she replied, "I'm not getting married to him." It was a story that even I found incredible. Mom had been working as a nurse at a local dialysis center, a job she'd held for a few months. Her boss, about 10 years her senior, asked her out to dinner one night. She obliged, and with her relationship in shambles, she agreed to marry him a week later. She told me on a Thursday. On Saturday, we moved into Ken's house. His home was my fourth in 2 years. Ken was born in Korea, but raised by an American veteran and his wife. During that first week in his house, I decided to inspect his small greenhouse and stumbled upon a relatively mature marijuana plant. I told Mom, who told Ken, and by the end of the day, it had been replaced with a tomato plant. When I confronted Ken, he stammered a bit and finally said, "It's for medicinal purposes. Don't worry about it." Ken's three children, a young girl and two boys about the same age as I was, found the new arrangement as strange as I did. The oldest boy fought constantly with Mom, which, thanks to the Appalachian Honor Code, meant that he fought constantly with me. Shortly before I went to bed one night, I came downstairs just as he called her a bitch. No self-respecting hillbilly could stand idly by, so I made it abundantly clear that I meant to beat my new stepbrother to within an inch of his life. So unquenchable was my appetite for violence that night that Mom and Ken decided that my new stepbrother and I should be separated. I wasn't even particularly angry. My desire to fight arose more out of a sense of duty, but it was a strong sense of duty, so Mom and I went to Mamaw's for the night. I remember watching an episode of The West Wing about education in America, which the majority of people rightfully believe is the key to opportunity. In it, the fictional president debates whether he should push school vouchers, giving money to school children so that they escape failing public schools, or instead focus exclusively on fixing those same failing schools. That debate is important, of course. For a long time, much of my failing school district qualified for vouchers, but it was striking that an entire discussion about why poor kids struggled in school, the emphasis rested entirely on public institutions. As a teacher at my old high school told me recently, they want us to be shepherds to these kids, but no one wants to talk about the fact that many of them are raised by wolves. I don't know what happened the day after Mom and I escaped Ken's to Mamaw's for the night. Maybe I had a test that I wasn't able to study for. Maybe I had a homework assignment due that I never had the time to complete. What I do know is that I was a sophomore in high school, and I was miserable. The constant moving and fighting, the seemingly endless carousel of new people I had to meet, learn to love, and then forget. This, and not my subpar public school, was the real barrier to opportunity. I didn't know it, but I was close to the precipice. I had nearly failed out of my freshman year of high school, earning a 2.1 GPA. I didn't do my homework, I didn't study, and my attendance was abysmal. Some days I'd fake an illness, and others I just refused to go. When I did go, I did so only to avoid a repeat of the letters the school had sent home a few years earlier, the ones that said if I didn't go to school, the administration would be forced to refer my case to county social services. Along with my abysmal school record came drug experimentation. Nothing hard, just what alcohol I could get my hands on, and a stash of weed that Ken's son and I found. Final proof, I suppose, that I did know the difference between a tomato plant and marijuana. For the first time in my life, I felt detached from Lindsay. She'd been married well over a year and had a toddler. There was something heroic about Lindsay's marriage, that after everything that she'd witnessed, she'd ended up with someone who treated her well and had a decent job. Lindsay seemed genuinely happy. She was a good mom who doted on her young son. She had a little house not far from Mamaw's and seemed to be finding her way. Though I felt happy for my sister, her new life heightened my sense of separation. For my entire existence, we had lived under the same roof. But now she lived in Middletown, and I lived with Ken about 20 miles away. While Lindsay built a life almost in opposition to the one she left behind, she would be a good mother, she would have a successful marriage, and only one. I found myself mired in the things that both of us hated. While Lindsay and her new husband took trips to Florida and California, I was stuck in a stranger's house in Miamisburg, Ohio. Chapter 9. Mamaw knew little of how this arrangement affected me, partly by design. During a long Christmas break, just a couple of months after I'd moved in with my new stepfather, I called her to complain. But when she answered, I could hear the voices of family in the background. My aunt, I thought, and cousin Gail, and perhaps some others. The background noise suggested holiday merriment, and I didn't have the heart to tell her what I had called to say. That I loathed living with these strangers, and that everything that had made my life to that point tolerable, the reprieve of her house, the company of my sister, had apparently vanished. I asked her to tell everyone whose voice I heard in the background that I loved them, and then I hung up the phone and marched upstairs to watch TV. I had never felt so alone. Happily, I continued to attend Middletown schools, which kept me in touch with my school friends and gave me an excuse to spend a few hours at Mamaw's. During active school sessions, I saw her a few times a week, and every time I did, she reminded me of the importance of doing well academically. She often remarked that if anyone in our family made it, it would be me. I didn't have the heart to tell her what was really happening. I was supposed to be a lawyer or a doctor or a businessman, not a high school dropout, but I was much closer to dropping out than I was to anything else. She learned the truth when Mom came to me one morning demanding a jar of clean urine. I had stayed at Mamaw's the night before and was getting ready for school when Mom walked in, frantic and out of breath. She had to submit to random urinalyses from the nursing board in order to keep her license, and someone had called that morning demanding a sample by the end of the day. Mamaw's piss was dirtied with a half dozen prescription drugs, so I was the only candidate. Mom's demand came with a strong air of entitlement. She had no remorse, no sense that she was asking me to do something wrong. Nor was there any guilt over the fact that she had broken yet another promise to never use drugs. I refused. Sensing my resistance, Mom transitioned. She became apologetic and desperate. She cried and begged. I promise I'll do better. I promise. I had heard it many times before, and I didn't believe it even a little. Lindsay once told me that above all, Mom was a survivor. She survived her childhood. She survived the men who came and went. She survived successive brushes with the law. And now she was doing everything she could to survive an encounter with the nursing board. I exploded. I told Mom that if she wanted clean piss, she should stop fucking up her life and get it from her own bladder. I told Mamaw that enabling Mom made it worse, and that if she had put her foot down 30 years earlier, then maybe Mom wouldn't be begging her son for clean piss. I told Mom that she was a shitty mother, and I told Mamaw that she was a shitty mother too. The color drained from Mamaw's face, and she refused to even look me in the eye. What I had said had clearly struck a nerve. Though I meant these things, I also knew that my urine might not be clean. Mom collapsed onto the couch, crying quietly, but Mamaw wouldn't give in so easily, even though I'd wounded her with my criticism. I pulled Mamaw into the bathroom and whispered a confession, that I had smoked Ken's pot twice in the past few weeks. I can't give it to her. If Mom takes my pee, we could both be in trouble. First, Mamaw assuaged my fears. A couple of hits of pot over 3 weeks wouldn't show up on the screen, she told me. Besides, you probably didn't know what the hell you were doing. You didn't inhale, even if you tried. Then she addressed the morality of it. I know this isn't right, honey, but she's your mother, and she's my daughter. And maybe, if we help her this time, she'll finally learn her lesson. It was the eternal hope, the thing to which I couldn't say no. That hope drove me to voluntarily attend those many NA meetings, consume books on addiction, and participate in Mom's treatment to the fullest extent that I could. It had driven me to get in the car with her when I was 12, knowing that her emotional state could lead her to do something she'd regret later. Mamaw never lost that hope, after more heartache and more disappointment than I could possibly fathom. Her life was a clinic in how to lose faith in people, but Mamaw always found a way to believe in the people she loved. So I don't regret relenting. Giving Mom that piss was wrong, but I'll never regret following Mamaw's lead. Her hope allowed her to forgive Papaw after the rough years of their marriage, and it convinced her to take me in when I needed her most. Though I followed Mamaw's lead, something inside me broke that morning. I went to school, red-eyed from crying and regretful that I'd helped. A few weeks earlier, I had sat with Mom at a Chinese buffet as she tried in vain to shovel food in her mouth. It's a memory that still makes my blood boil. Mom unable to open her eyes or close her mouth, spooning food in as it fell back on the plate. Other people stared at us, Ken was speechless, and Mom was oblivious. It was a prescription pain pill, or many of them, that had done this to her. I hated her for it and promised myself that if she ever did drugs again, I'd leave the house. The urine episode was the last straw for Mamaw, too. When I came home from school, Mamaw told me that she wanted me to stay with her permanently, with no more moving in between. Mom seemed not to care. She needed a break, she said, I supposed, from being a mother. She and Ken didn't last much longer. By the end of sophomore year, she had moved out of his house and I had moved in with Mamaw, never to return to the homes of Mom and her men. At least she passed her piss test. I didn't even have to pack, because much of what I owned remained at Mamaw's as I bounced from place to place. She didn't approve of me taking too many of my belongings to Ken's house, convinced that he and his kids might steal my socks and shirts. Neither Ken nor his children ever stole from me. Though I loved living with her, my new home tested my patience on many levels. I still harbored the insecurity that I was burdening her. More important, she was a hard woman to live with, quick-witted and sharp-tongued. If I didn't take out the garbage, she told me to stop being a lazy piece of shit. When I forgot to do my homework, she called me shit for brains and reminded me that unless I studied, I'd amount to nothing. She demanded that I play card games with her, usually gin rummy, and she never lost. You are the worst fucking card player I've ever met, she'd gloat. That one didn't make me feel bad. She said it to everyone she beat, and she beat everyone at gin rummy. Years later, every single one of my relatives, Aunt Wee, Uncle Jimmy, even Lindsay, repeated some version of, Mamaw was really hard on you, too hard. There were three rules in her house, get good grades, get a job, and get off your ass and help me. There was no set chore list, I just had to help her with whatever she was doing, and she never told me what to do. She just yelled at me if she did anything and I wasn't helping. But we had a lot of fun. Mamaw had a much bigger bark than bite, at least with me. She once ordered me to watch a TV show with her on a Friday night, a creepy murder mystery, the type of show Mamaw loved to watch. At the climax of the show, during a moment designed to make the viewer jump, Mamaw flipped off the lights and screamed in my ear. She'd seen the episode before and knew what was coming. She made me sit there for 45 minutes, just so she could scare me at the appointed time. The best part about living with Mamaw was that I began to understand what made her tick. Until then, I had resented how rarely we traveled to Kentucky after Mamaw Blanton's death. The decline in visits wasn't noticeable at first, but by the time I started middle school, we visited Kentucky only a few times a year for a few days at a time. Living with Mamaw, I learned that she and her sister Rose, a woman of uncommon kindness, had a falling out after their mother died. Mamaw had hoped that the old house would become a sort of family timeshare, while Rose had hoped that the house would go to her son and his family. Rose had a point. None of the siblings who lived in Ohio or Indiana visited often enough, so it made sense to give the house to someone who would use it. But Mamaw feared that without a home base, her children and grandchildren would have no place to stay during their visits to Jackson. She, too, had a point. I started to understand that Mamaw saw returning to Jackson as a duty to endure rather than a source of enjoyment. To me, Jackson was about my uncles and chasing turtles and finding peace from the instability that plagued my Ohio existence. Jackson gave me a shared home with Mamaw, a 3-hour road trip to tell and listen to stories, and a place where everyone knew me as the grandson of the famous Jim and Bonnie Vance. Jackson was something much different to her. It was the place where she sometimes went hungry as a child, from which she ran in the wake of a teenage pregnancy scandal, and where so many of her friends had given their lives in the mines. I wanted to escape to Jackson. She had escaped from it. In her old age, with limited mobility, Mamaw loved to watch TV. She preferred raunchy humor and epic dramas, so she had a lot of options. But her favorite show by far was the HBO mob story, The Sopranos. Looking back, it's hardly surprising that a show about fiercely loyal, sometimes violent outsiders resonated with Mamaw. Change the names and dates, and the Italian mafia starts to look a lot like the Hatfield-McCoy dispute back in Appalachia. The show's main character, Tony Soprano, was a violent killer, an objectively terrible person by almost any standard. But Mamaw respected his loyalty, and the fact that he would go to any length to protect the honor of his family. Though he murdered countless enemies and drank excessively, the only criticism she ever levied against him involved his infidelity. He's always sleeping around. I don't like that. I also saw for the first time Mamaw's love of children, not as an object of her affection, but as an observer of it. She often babysat for Lindsay's or Aunt Wee's young kids. One day she had both of Aunt Wee's girls for the day and Aunt Wee's dog in the backyard. When the dog barked, Mamaw screamed, "Shut up, you son of a bitch." My cousin Bonnie Rose ran to the back door and began screaming over and over, "Son of a bitch, son of a bitch." Mamaw hobbled over to Bonnie Rose and scooped her up in her arms. "Shh, you can't say that or you'll get me in trouble." But she was laughing so hard that she could barely get the words out. A few weeks later, I got home from school and asked Mamaw how her day had gone. She told me that she'd had a great day because she'd been watching Lindsay's son Cameron. He asked me if he could say fuck like I do. I told him yes, but only at my house. Then she chuckled quietly to herself. Regardless of how she felt, whether her emphysema made it difficult to breathe or her hip hurt so badly that she could barely walk, she never turned down an opportunity to spend time with those babies, as she put it. Mamaw loved them, and I began to understand why she had always dreamed of becoming a lawyer for abused and neglected children. At some point, Mamaw underwent major back surgery to help with the pain that made walking difficult. She landed in a nursing home for a few months to recover, forcing me to live alone, an experience that happily didn't last long. Every night she called Lindsay, Aunt Wee, or me and made the same request. "I hate the damn food here. Can you go to Taco Bell and get me a bean burrito?" Indeed, Mamaw hated everything about the nursing home and once asked me to promise that if she ever faced a permanent stay, I'd take her .44 Magnum and put a bullet in her head. "Mamaw, you can't ask me to do that. I'd go to jail for the rest of my life." "Well," she said, pausing for a moment to reflect, "then get your hands on some arsenic. That way, no one will know." Her back surgery, it turned out, was completely unnecessary. She had a broken hip, and as soon as the surgeon repaired it, she was back on her feet, though she used a walker or cane from then on. Now that I'm a lawyer, I marvel that we never considered a medical malpractice suit against the doctor who operated unnecessarily on her back. But Mamaw wouldn't have allowed it. She didn't believe in using the legal system until you had to. Sometimes I'd see Mom every few days, and sometimes I'd go a couple of weeks without hearing from her at all. After one breakup, she spent a few months on Mamaw's couch, and we both enjoyed her company. Mom tried in her own way. When she was working, she'd always give me money on paydays, almost certainly more than she could afford. For reasons I never quite understood, Mom equated money with affection. Perhaps she felt that I would never appreciate that she loved me unless she offered a wad of spending money. But I never cared about the money. I just wanted her to be healthy. Not even my closest friends knew that I lived in my grandma's house. I recognized that though many of my peers lacked the traditional American family, mine was more non-traditional than most. And we were poor, a status Mamaw wore like a badge of honor, but one I'd hardly come to grips with. I didn't wear clothes from Abercrombie & Fitch or American Eagle unless I'd received them for Christmas. When Mamaw picked me up from school, I'd ask her not to get out of the car lest my friends see her, wearing her uniform of baggy jeans and a men's t-shirt, with a giant menthol cigarette hanging from her lips. When people asked, I lied and told them that I lived with my mom, that she and I took care of my ailing grandmother. Even today, I still regret that far too many high school friends and acquaintances never knew Mamaw was the best thing that ever happened to me. My junior year, I tested into the Honors Advanced Math class, a hybrid of trigonometry, advanced algebra, and pre-calculus. The class's instructor, Ron Selby, enjoyed legendary status among the students for his brilliance and high demands. In 20 years, he had never missed a day of school. According to Middletown High School legend, a student called in a bomb threat during one of Selby's exams, hiding the explosive device in a bag in his locker. With the entire school evacuated outside, Selby marched into the school, retrieved the contents of the kids' locker, marched outside, and threw those contents into a trash can. "I've had that kid in class. He's not smart enough to make a functioning bomb," Selby told the police officers gathered at the school. "Now let my students go back to class and finish their exams." Mamaw loved stories like this, and though she never met Selby, she admired him and encouraged me to follow his lead. Selby encouraged, but didn't require, his students to obtain advanced graphing calculators. The Texas Instruments Model 89 was the latest and greatest. We didn't have cell phones, and we didn't have nice clothes, but Mamaw made sure that I had one of those graphing calculators. This taught me an important lesson about Mamaw's values, and it forced me to engage with school in a way I never had before. If Mamaw could drop $180 on a graphing calculator, she insisted that I spend none of my own money, then I had better take schoolwork more seriously. I owed it to her, and she reminded me of it constantly. "Have you finished your work for that Selby teacher?" "No, Mamaw, not yet." "You damn well better start. I didn't spend every penny I had on that little computer so you could fuck around all day." Those 3 years with Mamaw, uninterrupted and alone, saved me. I didn't notice the causality of the change, how living with her turned my life around. I didn't notice that my grades began to improve immediately after I moved in, and I couldn't have known that I was making lifelong friends. During that time, Mamaw and I started to talk about the problems in our community. Mamaw encouraged me to get a job. She told me that it would be good for me and that I needed to learn the value of a dollar. When her encouragement fell on deaf ears, she then demanded that I get a job, and so I did, as a cashier at a local grocery store. Working as a cashier turned me into an amateur sociologist. A frenetic stress animated so many of our customers. One of our neighbors would walk in and yell at me for the smallest of transgressions, not smiling at her, or bagging the groceries too heavy one day or too light the next. Some came into the store in a hurry, pacing between aisles, looking frantically for a particular item. But others waded through the aisles deliberately, carefully marking each item off their list. Some folks purchased a lot of canned and frozen food, while others consistently arrived at the checkout counter with carts piled high with fresh produce. The more harried a customer, the more they purchased pre-cooked or frozen food, the more likely they were to be poor. And I knew they were poor because of the clothes they wore, or because they purchased their food with food stamps. After a few months, I came home and asked Mamaw why only poor people bought baby formula. Don't rich people have babies too? Mamaw had no answers, and it would be many years before I learned that rich folks are considerably more likely to breastfeed their children. As my job taught me a little more about America's class divide, it also imbued me with a bit of resentment, directed toward both the wealthy and my own kind. The owners of Dillman's were old-fashioned, so they allowed people with good credit to run grocery tabs, some of which surpassed $1,000. I knew that if any of my relatives walked in and ran up a bill of over $1,000, they'd be asked to pay immediately. I hated the feeling that my boss counted my people as less trustworthy than those who took their groceries home in a Cadillac. But I got over it. One day, I told myself, I'll have my own damn tab. I also learned how people gamed the welfare system. They'd buy 2 dozen packs of soda with food stamps and then sell them at a discount for cash. They'd ring up their orders separately, buying food with food stamps and beer, wine, and cigarettes with cash. They'd regularly go through the checkout line speaking on their cell phones. I could never understood why our lives felt like such a struggle, while those living off of government largesse enjoyed trinkets that I only dreamed about. Mamaw listened intently to my experiences at Dillman's. We began to view much of our fellow working class with mistrust. Most of us were struggling to get by, but we made do, worked hard, and hoped for a better life. But a large minority was content to live off the dole. Every 2 weeks, I'd get a small paycheck and notice the line where federal and state income taxes were deducted from my wages. At least as often, our drug addict neighbor would buy T-bone steaks, which I was too poor to buy for myself but was forced by Uncle Sam to buy for someone else. This was my mindset when I was 17, and though I'm far less angry today than I was then, it was my first indication that the policies of Mamaw's Party of the Working Man, the Democrats, weren't all they were cracked up to be. Political scientists have spent millions of words trying to explain how Appalachia and the South went from staunchly Democratic to staunchly Republican in less than a generation. Some blame race relations and the Democratic Party's embrace of the Civil Rights Movement. Others cite religious faith and the hold that social conservatism has on evangelicals in that region. A big part of the explanation lies in the fact that many in the white working class saw precisely what I did working at Dillman's. As far back as the 1970s, the white working class began to turn to Richard Nixon because of a perception that, as one man put it, government was paying people who are on welfare today doing nothing. They're laughing at our society, and we're all hard-working people, and we're getting laughed at for working every day. At around that time, our neighbor, one of Mamaw and Papaw's oldest friends, registered the house next to ours for Section 8. Section 8 is a government program that offers low-income residents a voucher to rent housing. Mamaw's friend had little luck renting his property, but when he qualified his house for the Section 8 voucher, he virtually assured that would change. Mamaw saw it as betrayal, ensuring that bad people would move into the neighborhood and drive down property values. Despite our efforts to draw bright lines between the working and non-working poor, Mamaw and I recognized that we shared a lot in common with those who we thought gave our people a bad name. Those Section 8 recipients looked a lot like us. The matriarch of the first family to move in next door was born in Kentucky, but moved north at a young age as her parents sought a better life. She'd gotten involved with a couple of men, each of whom had left her with a child but no support. She was nice, and so were her kids. But the drugs and the late-night fighting revealed troubles that too many hillbilly transplants knew too well. Confronted with such a realization of her own family's struggle, Mamaw grew frustrated and angry. From that anger sprang Bonnie Vance, the social policy expert. She's a lazy whore, but she wouldn't be if she was forced to get a job. I hate those fuckers for giving these people the money to move into our neighborhood. She'd ran against the people we'd see in the grocery store. I can't understand why people who've worked all their lives scrape by while these deadbeats buy liquor and cell phone coverage with our tax money. These were bizarre views from my bleeding heart grandma. And if she blasted the government for doing too much one day, she'd blast it for doing too little the next. The government, after all, was just helping poor people find a place to live, and my grandma loved the idea of anyone helping the poor. She had no philosophical objection to Section 8 vouchers, so the Democrat in her would resurface. She'd rant about the lack of jobs and wonder aloud whether that was why our neighbor couldn't find a good man. In her more compassionate moments, Mamaw asked if it made any sense that our society could afford aircraft carriers but not drug treatment facilities, like Mom's, for everyone. Sometimes she'd criticize the faceless rich, whom she saw as far too unwilling to carry their fair share of the social burden. Mamaw saw every ballot failure of the local school improvement tax, and there were many, as an indictment of our society's failure to provide a quality education to kids like me. Mamaw's sentiments occupied wildly different parts of the political spectrum. Depending on her mood, Mamaw was a radical conservative or a European-style social democrat. Because of this, I initially assumed that Mamaw was an unreformed simpleton, and that as soon as she opened her mouth about policy or politics, I might as well close my ears. Yet I quickly realized that in Mamaw's contradictions lay great wisdom. I had spent so long just surviving my world, but now that I had little space to observe it, I began to see the world as Mamaw did. I was scared, confused, angry, and heartbroken. I'd blame large businesses for closing up shop and moving overseas, and then I'd wonder if I might have done the same thing. I'd curse our government for not helping enough, and then I'd wonder if, in its attempts to help, it actually made the problem worse. Mamaw could spew venom like a Marine Corps drill instructor, but what she saw in our community didn't just piss her off. It broke her heart. Behind the drugs, and the fighting matches, and the financial struggles, these were people with serious problems, and they were hurting. Our neighbors had a kind of desperate sadness in their lives. You'd see it in how the mother would grin but never really smile, or in the jokes that the teenage girl told about her mother smacking the shit out of her. I knew what awkward humor like this was meant to conceal because I'd used it in the past. Grin and bear it, says the adage. If anyone appreciated this, Mamaw did. The problems of our community hit close to home. Mom's struggles weren't some isolated incident. They were replicated, replayed, and relived by many of the people who, like us, had moved hundreds of miles in search of a better life. There was no end in sight. Mamaw had thought she escaped the poverty of the hills, but the poverty, emotional if not financial, had followed her. Something had made her later years eerily similar to her earliest ones. What was happening? What were our neighbor's teenage daughter's prospects? Certainly the odds were against her with a home life like that. This raised the question, what would happen to me? I was unable to answer these questions in a way that didn't implicate something deep within the place I called home. What I knew is that other people didn't live like we did. When I visited Uncle Jimmy, I did not wake to the screams of neighbors. In Aunt Wee and Dan's neighborhood, homes were beautiful and lawns well manicured, and police came around to smile and wave but never to load someone's mom or dad in the back of their cruiser. So I wondered what was different about us. Not just me and my family, but our neighborhood and our town and everyone from Jackson to Middletown and beyond. When Mom was arrested a couple of years earlier, the neighborhood's porches and front yards filled with spectators. There's no embarrassment like waving to the neighbors right after the cops have carted your mother off. Mom's exploits were undoubtedly extreme, but all of us had seen the show before with different neighbors. These sorts of things had their own rhythm. A mild screaming match might invite a few cracked shutters or peeking eyes behind the shades. If things escalated a bit, bedrooms would illuminate as people awoke to investigate the commotion. And if things got out of hand, the police would come and take someone's drunk dad or unhinged mom down to the city building. That building housed the tax collector, the public utilities, and even a small museum, but all the kids in my neighborhood knew it as the home of Middletown's short-term jail. I consume books about social policy and the working poor. One book in particular, a study by eminent sociologist William Julius Wilson called The Truly Disadvantaged, struck a nerve. I was 16 the first time I read it, and though I didn't fully understand it all, I grasped the core thesis. As millions migrated north to factory jobs, the communities that sprouted up around those factories were vibrant but fragile. When the factories shut their doors, the people left behind were trapped in towns and cities that could no longer support such large populations with high-quality work. Those who could, generally the well-educated, wealthy, or well-connected, left, leaving behind communities of poor people. These remaining folks were the truly disadvantaged, unable to find good jobs on their own and surrounded by communities that offered little in the way of connections or social support. Wilson's book spoke to me. I wanted to write him a letter and tell him that he had described my home perfectly. That it resonated so personally is odd, however, because he wasn't writing about the hillbilly transplants from Appalachia. He was writing about black people in the inner cities. The same was true of Charles Murray's seminal Losing Ground, another book about black folks that could have been written about hillbillies, which addressed the way our government encouraged social decay through the welfare state. Though insightful, neither of these books fully answered the questions that plagued me. Why didn't our neighbor leave that abusive man? Why did she spend her money on drugs? Why couldn't she see that her behavior was destroying her daughter? Why were all of these things happening, not just to our neighbor, but to my mom? It would be years before I learned that no single book, or expert, or field could fully explain the problems of hillbillies in modern America. Our elegy is a sociological one, yes, but it is also about psychology and community and culture and faith. During my junior year of high school, our neighbor Patty called her landlord to report a leaky roof. The landlord arrived and found Patty topless, stoned, and unconscious on her living room couch. Upstairs, the bathtub was overflowing, hence the leaking roof. Patty had apparently drawn herself a bath, taken a few prescription painkillers, and passed out. The top floor of her home and many of her family's possessions were ruined. This is the reality of our community. It's about a naked druggie destroying what little of value exists in her life. It's about children who lose their toys and clothes to a mother's addiction. Another neighbor lived alone in a big pink house. She was a recluse, a neighborhood mystery. She came outside only to smoke. She never said hello, and her lights were always off. She and her husband had divorced, and her children had landed in jail. She was extremely obese. As a child, I used to wonder if she hated the outdoors because she was too heavy to move. There were the neighbors down the street, a younger woman with a toddler and her middle-aged boyfriend. The boyfriend worked, and the woman spent her days watching the young and the restless. Her young son was adorable, and he loved Mamaw. At all times of the day, one time past midnight, he would wander to her doorstep and ask for a snack. His mother had all the time in the world, but she couldn't keep a close enough watch on her child to prevent him from straying into the homes of strangers. Sometimes his diaper would need changing. Mamaw once called social services on the woman, hoping they'd somehow rescue the young boy. They did nothing. So Mamaw used my nephew's diapers and kept a watchful eye on the neighborhood, always looking for signs of her little buddy. My sister's friend lived in a small duplex with her mother, a welfare queen if one ever existed. She had 7 siblings, most of them from the same father, which was, unfortunately, a rarity. Her mother had never held a job and seemed interested only in breeding, as Mamaw put it. Her kids never had a chance. One ended up in an abusive relationship that produced a child before the mom was old enough to purchase cigarettes. The oldest overdosed on drugs and was arrested not long after he graduated from high school. This was my world, a world of truly irrational behavior. We spend our way into the poorhouse. We buy giant TVs and iPads. Our children wear nice clothes thanks to high-interest credit cards and payday loans. We purchase homes we don't need, refinance them for more spending money, and declare bankruptcy, often leaving them full of garbage in our wake. Thrift is inimical to our being. We spend to pretend that we're upper class, and when the dust clears, when bankruptcy hits, or a family member bails us out of our stupidity, there's nothing left over. Nothing for the kids' college tuition, no investment to grow our wealth, no rainy day fund if someone loses her job. We know we shouldn't spend like this. Sometimes we beat ourselves up over it, but we do it anyway. Our homes are a chaotic mess. We scream and yell at each other like we're spectators at a football game. At least one member of the family uses drugs, sometimes the father, sometimes the mother, sometimes both. At especially stressful times, we'll hit and punch each other, all in front of the rest of the family, including young children. Much of the time, the neighbors hear what's happening. A bad day is when the neighbors call the police to stop the drama. Our kids go to foster care but never stay for long. We apologize to our kids. The kids believe we're really sorry, and we are. But then we act just as mean a few days later. We don't study as children, and we don't make our kids study when we're parents. Our kids perform poorly in school. We might get angry with them, but we never give them the tools, like peace and quiet at home, to succeed. Even the best and brightest will likely go to college close to home if they survive the war zone in their own home. I don't care if you got into Notre Dame, we say. You can get a fine, cheap education at the community college. The irony is that for poor people like us, an education at Notre Dame is both cheaper and finer. We choose not to work when we should be looking for jobs. Sometimes we'll get a job, but it won't last. We'll get fired for tardiness, or for stealing merchandise and selling it on eBay, or for having a customer complain about the smell of alcohol on our breath, or for taking 5 30-minute restroom breaks per shift. We talk about the value of hard work, but tell ourselves that the reason we're not working is some perceived unfairness. Obama shut down the coal mines, or all the jobs went to the Chinese. These are the lies we tell ourselves to solve the cognitive dissonance, the broken connection between the world we see and the values we preach. We talk to our children about responsibility, but we never walk the walk. It's like this. For years, I dreamed of owning a German Shepherd puppy. Somehow Mom found me one, but he was our fourth dog, and I had no clue how to train him. Within a few years, all of them had vanished, given to the police department or to a family friend. After saying goodbye to the fourth dog, our hearts harden. We learn not to grow too attached. Our eating and exercise habits seem designed to send us to an early grave, and it's working. In certain parts of Kentucky, local life expectancy is 67, a full decade and a half below what it is in nearby Virginia. A recent study found that unique among all ethnic groups in the United States, the life expectancy of working-class white folks is going down. We eat Pillsbury cinnamon rolls for breakfast, Taco Bell for lunch, and McDonald's for dinner. We rarely cook, even though it's cheaper and better for the body and soul. Exercise is confined to the games we play as children. We see people jog on the streets only if we leave our homes for the military or for college in some distant place. Not all of the white working class struggles. I knew even as a child that there were two separate sets of social pressures. My grandparents embodied one type: old-fashioned, quietly faithful, self-reliant, hard-working. My mother, and increasingly the entire neighborhood, embodied another: consumerist, isolated, angry, distrustful. There were, and remain, many who lived by my grandparents' code. Sometimes you saw it in the subtlest of ways. The old neighbor who diligently tended her garden even as her neighbors let their homes rot from the inside out. The young woman who grew up with my mom, who returned to the neighborhood every day to help her mother navigate old age. I say this not to romanticize my grandparents' way of life, which, as I've observed, was rife with problems, but to note that many in our community may have struggled but did so successfully. There are many intact families, many dinners shared in peaceful homes, many children studying hard and believing that they'll claim their own American dream. Many of my friends have built successful lives and happy families in Middletown or nearby. They are not the problem, And if you believe the statistics, the children of these intact homes have plenty of reason for optimism. I always straddled those two worlds. Thanks to Mamaw, I never saw only the worst of what our community offered, and I believe that saved me. There was always a safe place and a loving embrace if I ever needed it. Our neighbors' kids couldn't say the same. One Sunday, Mamaw agreed to watch Aunt Wee's kids for several hours. Aunt Wee dropped them off at 10. I had to work the dreaded 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. shift at the grocery store. I hung out with the kids for about 45 minutes, then left 10:45 for work. I was unusually upset, devastated even, to leave them. I wanted nothing more than to spend the day with Mamaw and the babies. I told Mamaw that, and instead of telling me to quit your damn whining like I expected, she told me she wished that I could stay home too. It was a rare moment of empathy. But if you want the sort of work where you can spend the weekends with your family, you've got to go to college and make something of yourself. That was the essence of Mamaw's genius. She didn't just preach and cuss and demand. She showed me what was possible, a peaceful Sunday afternoon with the people I loved, and made sure I knew how to get there. Reams of social science attest to the positive effect of a loving and stable home. I could cite a dozen studies suggesting that Mamaw's home offered me not just a short-term haven, but also hope for a better life. Entire volumes are devoted to the phenomenon of resilient children, kids who prosper despite an unstable home because they have the social support of a loving adult. I know Mamaw was good for me not because some Harvard psychologist says so, but because I felt it. Consider my life before I moved in with Mamaw. In the middle of the third grade, we left Middletown and my grandparents to live in Preble County with Bob. At the end of fourth grade, we left Preble County to live in a Middletown duplex on the 200 block of McKinley Street. At the end of fifth grade, we left the 200 block of McKinley Street to move to the 300 block of McKinley Street, and by that time, Chip was a regular in our home, though he never lived with us. At the end of sixth grade, we remained on the 300 block of McKinley Street, but Chip had been replaced by Steve, and there were many discussions about moving in with Steve. At the end of seventh grade, Matt had taken Steve's place, Mom was preparing to move in with Matt, and Mom hoped that I would join her in Dayton. At the end of eighth grade, she demanded that I move to Dayton, and after a brief detour at my dad's house, I acquiesced. At the end of ninth grade, I moved in with Ken, a complete stranger, and his three kids. On top of all that were the drugs, the domestic violence case, children's services prying into our lives, and Papaw dying. Today, even remembering that period long enough to write it down invokes an intense, indescribable anxiety in me. Not long ago, I noticed that a Facebook friend, an acquaintance from high school with similarly deep hillbilly roots, was constantly changing boyfriends, going in and out of relationships, posting pictures of one guy 1 week and another 3 weeks later, fighting on social media with her new fling until the relationship publicly imploded. She is my age with four children, and when she posted that she had finally found a man who would treat her well, a refrain I'd seen many times before, her 13-year-old daughter commented, "Just stop. I want you and this to stop." I wish I could hug that little girl, because I know how she feels. For 7 long years, I just wanted it to stop. I didn't care so much about the fighting, the screaming, or even the drugs. I just wanted a home, and I wanted to stay there, and I wanted these goddamn strangers to stay the fuck out. Now, consider the sum of my life after I moved in with Mamaw permanently. At the end of 10th grade, I lived with Mamaw, in her house, with no one else. At the end of 11th grade, I lived with Mamaw, in her house, with no one else. At the end of 12th grade, I lived with Mamaw, in her house, with no one else. I could say that the peace of Mamaw's home gave me a safe space to do my homework. I could say that the absence of fighting and instability let me focus on school and my job. I could say that spending all of my time in the same house with the same person made it easier for me to form lasting friendships with people at school. I could say that having a job and learning a bit about the world helped clarify precisely what I wanted out of my own life. In hindsight, those explanations make sense, and I'm certain that a bit of truth lies in each. I'm sure that a sociologist and a psychologist, sitting in a room together, could explain why I lost interest in drugs, why my grades improved, why I aced the SAT, and why I found a couple of teachers who inspired me to love learning. But what I remember most of all is that I was happy. I no longer feared the school bell at the end of the day. I knew where I'd be living the next month, and no one's romantic decisions affected my life. And out of that happiness came so many of the opportunities I've had for the past 12 years. Chapter 10. During my last year of high school, I tried out for the varsity golf team. For about a year, I'd taken golf lessons from an old golf pro. The summer before senior year, I got a job at a local golf course so I could practice for free. Mamaw never showed any interest in sports, but she encouraged me to learn golf because that's where rich people do business. Though wise in her own way, Mamaw knew little about the business habits of rich people, and I told her as much. "Shut up, you fucker," she told me. "Everybody knows rich people love to golf." But when I practiced my swing in the house, I didn't use a ball, so the only damage I did was to the floor, she demanded that I stop ruining her carpet. "But Mamaw," I protested sarcastically, "if you don't let me practice, I'll never get to do any business on the golf course. I might as well drop out of high school now and get a job bagging groceries." "You smartass, if I wasn't crippled, I'd get up right now and smack your head and ass together." So she helped me pay for my lessons and asked her baby brother, my Uncle Gary, the youngest of the Blanton boys, to find me some old clubs. He delivered a nice set of McGregor's, better than anything we could have afforded on our own, and I practiced as often as I could. By the time golf tryouts rolled around, I had mastered enough of a golf swing not to embarrass myself. I didn't make the team, though I did show enough improvement to justify practicing with my friends who had made the team, and that was all I really wanted. I learned that Mamaw was right. Golf was a rich person's game. At the course where I worked, few of our customers came from Middletown's working-class neighborhoods. On my first day of golf practice, I showed up in dress shoes, thinking that was what golf shoes were. When an enterprising young bully noticed before the first tee that I was wearing a pair of Kmart brown loafers, he proceeded to mock me mercilessly for the next 4 hours. I resisted the urge to bury my putter in his goddamn ear, remembering Mamaw's sage advice to act like you've been there. A note about hillbilly loyalty. Reminded of that story recently, Lindsay launched into a tirade about how much of a loser the kid was. The incident occurred 13 years ago. I knew in the back of my mind that decisions were coming about my future. All of my friends planned to go to college. That I had such motivated friends was due to Mamaw's influence. By the time I was in 7th grade, many of my neighborhood friends were already smoking weed. Mamaw found out and forbade me to see any of them. I recognized that most kids ignore instructions like these, but most kids don't receive them from the likes of Bonnie Vance. She promised that if she saw me in the presence of any person on the banned list, she would run him over with her car. "No one would ever find out," she whispered menacingly. With my friends headed for college, I figured I'd do the same. I scored well enough on the SAT to overcome my earlier bad grades, and I knew that the only two schools I had any interest in attending, Ohio State and Miami University, would both accept me. A few months before I graduated, I had, admittedly with little thought, settled on Ohio State. A large package arrived in the mail filled with financial aid information from the university. There was talk of Pell Grants, subsidized loans, unsubsidized loans, scholarships, and something called work study. It was all so exciting, if only Mamaw and I could figure out what it meant. We puzzled over the forms for hours before concluding that I could purchase a decent home in Middletown with the debt I'd incurred to go to college. We hadn't actually started the forms yet. That would require another Herculean effort on another day. Excitement turned to apprehension, but I reminded myself that college was an investment in my future. "It's the only damn thing worth spending money on right now," Mamaw said. She was right, but as I worried less about the financial aid forms, I began to worry for another reason. I wasn't ready. Not all investments are good investments. All of that debt, and for what? To get drunk all the time and earn terrible grades? Doing well in college required grit, and I had far too little of it. My high school record left much to be desired. Dozens of absences and tardy arrivals, and no school activities to speak of. I was undoubtedly on an upward trajectory, but even toward the end of high school, C's and easy classes revealed a kid unprepared for the rigors of advanced education. In Mamaw's house, I was healing, yet as we combed through those financial aid papers, I couldn't shake the feeling that I had a long way to go. Everything about the unstructured college experience terrified me. From feeding myself healthy food to paying my own bills. I'd never done any of those things, but I knew that I wanted more out of my life. I knew that I wanted to excel in college, get a good job, and give my family the things I'd never had. I just wasn't ready to start that journey. That's when my cousin Rachel, a Marine Corps veteran, advised that I consider the Corps. They'll whip your ass into shape. Rachel was Uncle Jimmy's oldest daughter, and thus the dean of our generation of grandchildren. All of us, even Lindsay, looked up to Rachel, so her advice carried enormous weight. The 9/11